Yeah, I mean, my number one advice to founders is conviction and persistence. So if you see a problem that's out there, then don't think too much about who else is solving it or how big the market is. Just go and solve the problem and persist and believe, you know, believe in it. And there's going to be ups and downs. There's going to be enough people, you know, telling you that like, hey, look, you know, I see this problem, but I don't see myself paying for it. Don't worry about all of that part. If you think that, you know, it's a large enough problem, like a lot of people face it, having that conviction and belief and like staying on course is, I think, this is the most important thing.
Welcome to the Product Market Fit Show, brought to you by Mistral, a seed stage firm based in Canada. I'm Pablo. I'm a founder turned VC. My goal is to help early stage founders like you find product market fit. Well, Arvind, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So listen, I've got your LinkedIn open right here. I'm looking through it. 10 years, distinguished engineer at Google. And the claim to fame, as far as I understand it, is you made Google search as fast as a blink of an eye. Then you go off, you start Rubrik. That actually is filing for IPO now. They're doing like $500 million in revenue, you know, worth $5 to $10 billion. But, you know, that wasn't enough for you. You kind of left halfway through that story, started Glean, which is what you're working on today. And you just raised $200 million for that at, you know, over $2 billion valuation. So my first question, honestly, is like, what's the secret, man? What am I doing wrong?
Well, I mean, no secrets. You know, I would just say, you know, I've been so fortunate to be actually, you know, be with people who want to build great products and achieve some success with them. So excited, you know, with, you know, what we've done with Rubrik, what we're doing with Glean.
Well, then let's dive in a little bit. We'll spend almost the entire episode on Glean, but just to get some context, like walk me through just leaving Google, especially at the state that you were at. Obviously, it's a, let's call it a very comfortable position for a bit of a euphemism, but to decide to go off on your own and start your startup, like what drove you to do that? And yeah, just walk me through that thinking.
So, you know, I really enjoyed working at Google. I always got to get a chance to work on products that were really meaningful that, like, you know, everybody around me uses. So it was amazing. And I had no plans as such to actually go and start a company. I was not feeling any kind of unrest. Sometimes, you know, problems come, you know, come to you. And in this case, you know, my co-founder, Bipul, and I, you know, we chatted about, like, you know, this problem that we ultimately, like, you know, built Rubrik, you know, for. And it was exciting to me. And I just felt that like it would be great to actually, you know, go and do something, you know, on your own, not have this sort of like always have this, you know, like a big support system, you know, that you have behind. Because sometimes, you know, I feel like, you know, at Google, I was not feeling challenged anymore because, you know, we're such a successful company and we could always, you know, take big problems, you know, and work on them. And it didn't matter if they failed because, like, you know, like as an individual, like, you know, you move on and you start a new project. And sometimes that also makes you dull. And so here, like, it was actually interesting for me to actually see, like, you know, like, okay, like, let me see, you know, what I can prove.
No safety net, kind of burn all boats. It either works or it doesn't.
Yeah. And of course, like, you know, it was we know that, like, you know, if you succeed, you know, that actually, you know, it's going to feel totally special.
And so you go through this journey. Things are going quite well. I mean, you know, I believe you raised this Series E or so. This is like the 2018, 2019 timeframe. How does the idea of Glean come up? And then how do you work through, you're the founder, you're one of the founders. Like, how do you work through exploring that and ultimately leaving? Walk me through that period.
So we ran into this problem that Glean solves at Rubrik. We were really, really lucky at Rubrik to grow, you know, the business really quickly. In four years, we were actually more than 1,000 people in the company. But with that growth, you know, came challenges. And one of them was that our productivity actually dropped quite a bit. Whether it's engineers, like they're not able to write as much code, salespeople are not able to sell as much stuff. Overall, we felt that like we were investing so much. We'd actually triple the size of the engineering team, but like, you know, still write, you know, the same amount of code. Like, it doesn't matter how many people you bring in, like you don't get more things done. And so we would run these, you know, surveys, pulse surveys, and ask people what's wrong, like, you know, or like with the company, or what are the things we can do better on. And always you would see this one problem that, you know, was top of mind for people. This was one of the, like, I think the default questions in the survey, which was that like, people would complain that I cannot find any information, you know, in this company. I don't know where to go and look for things, and I don't know who to go and ask for help. And this was a big problem. And when it became clearly the largest problem there, I thought about it. It resonated with me because I felt the same way. In fact, everybody in the company felt the same way. There's so much data, so much knowledge across so many different systems, nobody knew, like, you know, what stuff was where.
Would you say that's even worse at a fast-growing startup? Just because if you think about 0 to 1,000 employees, that means, you know, most of them got hired in the last year. Like, they don't even know what they don't know, sort of thing. So was that, like, exacerbated at Rubrik?
Yeah, it was definitely exacerbated because, like, it was a fast-growing company. When we saw this problem, like, you know, we wanted to solve it. And so we went and talked to a few other companies just to see, like, you know, if they were running into this problem, like, you know, what are the solutions for this? And we realized that this was such a common problem. Like, you know, every employee in every company in the world sort of struggles with this. And they were struggling more and more, like, you know, as we were going through this SaaS transformation, like, you know, where, like, suddenly, like, you know, businesses started to use hundreds of systems and applications, and your knowledge got really fragmented.
What was your role, by the way, at Rubrik at that time?
I was the head of R&D, so I actually was responsible for all product development. But I was also, like, I guess founder, I would actually also look at issues like these, you know, internally, like, how can we make our company better? Initially, like, and I'm a search engineer, so when I see that people can't find things, like, I say, okay, yeah, like, let's go and buy a search engine.
That hits deep, yeah.
So we tried to go and find one, and I didn't find anything to buy. And I was really shocked. I said, like, what, like, you know, this is such a, you know, such a commonplace problem. Like, you know, how come there's not even a single product that I can go and buy for this? So that sort of led to that initial, like, you know, thought process of, like, hey, maybe, like, you know, maybe I should go and solve this. You know, we thought about, like, maybe, like, you know, I should build a second product in Rubrik, but it just felt like, you know, it didn't make sense for us. Like, you know, we were in such a large market already with a small market share, so all of our focus there had to be on our existing product.
Was that a tough conversation internally, like, you ultimately going to your other co-founders and saying, actually, you know, I think I'm just going to go off on my own and start something new?
Well, it was tough for me internally first, like, you know, before I even discussed with somebody. So I had to figure out, you know, like, you know, why, like, you know, how, like, you know, does it make sense, why? So, but, you know, we'd actually built the organization, like, you know, to an extent where we had great leaders. And they were doing a great job. In fact, they were better than me. And I felt like, you know, I had the ability to sort of, like, do a really good, like, you know, smooth transition and start clean. So, but I was so excited about it. And it's a problem that is something that I feel is really fundamental. We believe that, you know, we make such a big impact, you know, on the lives of people who use our product.
Now, weren't there, like, just thinking through this problem, like you said, it was a problem that everybody faced, and in a sense, it classified in the world of, like, obvious problems that are just really hard to solve. But weren't there some, I remember, like, Dropbox, I think, had put something out in this space, or was at least marketing that they had a solution. Like, were there a lot of big names going after this problem as well?
Well, historically, like, this is not a new problem, like, helping employees find information at work. So there've been companies, you know, Google had a product too, but nobody really solved it in a way where somebody liked the product, somebody actually, you know, where the problem actually got solved. But overall, I would say, like, it was more of a neglected space as opposed to a space where a lot of companies were thinking about doing something. And so when we came in, we built the product. We felt that we were the only ones who were truly focused on bringing assistance, you know, to employees. With the product, you know, like ours. So most of our journey has felt like, you know, more like creating the market for it as opposed to competing with other vendors with a better product.
So walk me through those early days. You finally do decide to leave Rubrik. And my understanding is you kind of raised that, I think it was $15 million round right out of the gate. What was that process like? Was it relatively straightforward just because of your background and what you'd kind of proven so far?
Yeah, the process of raising capital was relatively smooth, but I think it was interesting. Like, you know, there were investors who would tell me, like, you know, that they would back me, you know, because I've experienced building a company before, but they didn't want to back, you know, the idea that I was working on. So there was some struggle because I think this was a difficult problem. There were no successes in enterprise search, which is, like, you know, how people clubbed us, you know, as you know, into that category. And so rightfully so, like, there was some hesitation from investors, but you always, you know, find ultimately there are, like, great investors who have the capacity to actually take on big challenges. Like, they're not afraid of all the risks.
And what's kind of the first step? Like, you kind of already validated the idea. So do you just go right into building the product, or what do you focus on in those early days?
So first thing first, right? So I think for me, the validation happened, you know, just like it was inherent, you know, it was sort of actually something that was fundamental, something that just I believed in. Like I didn't need anyone to validate. In fact, the more people I would talk to, like, you know, especially people who have business acumen, like they would actually turn me farther from this idea. So I actually chose not to talk to too many people.
How come? Like, what would they say? Were they not aware? Like, they didn't feel the problem themselves, or was it something else?
Everybody feels the problem, but everybody felt in those days that, like, hey, I can live, you know, with it. I can live with this problem.
Like a nice to have.
So I feel like, yeah, I feel like, you know, this is a nice to have. This is a vitamin. This is not a painkiller. And you know, like, you know, I have a much more simplistic thought process. Like, I don't, like, think about those. I'm not a business person either. But for me, you know, it was like, you know, like, you know, I was going with the engineering mindset, which is that, look, like, you know, I know all these engineers, they're spending one third of their time just trying to find things. They're frustrated. And, you know, there's some value to be created here. So part of it was that, like, you know, just that belief. And actually, not just me, whoever we hired, like, you know, in our, you know, initial founding team and the people who we hired after that, all the people who came to work at Glean had the same level of belief in the problem that we're trying to solve. And that's the only reason they came. That is a problem that they faced in their work lives, and they knew it was important. And they were also engineers. Like, initially, you know, you hire engineers, so you don't think about, like, you know, like the vitamin and the painkiller and the nice to have versus must have. And, like, that's not how you think. Like, you just go and solve a problem. So that's our initial journey, is to sort of, like, and I think it's important. Like, it's important sometimes not to overanalyze and actually focus on the end user and the problem and just go and solve it.
Well, it's interesting. A lot of these vitamins, they feel like that until, like you said, you have the thing, and then you realize you can't live without it anymore. And then it's effectively a painkiller because you kind of create the pain, right? And did you do, like, I'm curious, back then, you know, you talk about overanalyzing, which this is a theme that I've seen through and through in so many of these early stories. Things work because people build something that solves problems, and then the market presented itself. How much thinking did you do at the time of TAM analysis, market size, pricing, all these sort of things?
Well, that's a great question. Like, you know, sometimes we sort of talk to our team about it. So we didn't do any TAM analysis. Like, how do you do TAM? Like, there's no product in the market. Nobody actually is even solving this problem. And so you had to really, basically, like, you know, my mindset was that this is fundamental. Initially, like, you know, when people or, like, investors ask me, okay, what's the TAM or how big is this opportunity? And, or, like, how would you even figure out how much people would pay for it? Like, what should be the price? And what's the ROI? How are you going to prove the ROI? You won't be able to prove the ROI because, you know, like, saving time is so sort of nebulous. And so my question to them would be always that, okay, think about, like, you know, email. Do you think you need email in your company? And nobody doubts it. I said, what's the ROI of it? Nobody can come up with the ROI either.
Slack was a great one like that. I remember when it came out, we were a startup paying for Slack, and our CFO was like, you guys really need to pay for this? I'm like, yes, do not take this out.
So some things are fundamental, and we felt that search is like that. Like, look, you're trying to find things, you know, and to get work done. It's important. Then, like, especially in this new world where knowledge is exploding, like every year you double your knowledge inside your company, and you spread that knowledge across like 30% more systems at 300 different places. Like, enterprises have thousands of applications, and all your knowledge is spread across all those places. How are you going to find anything? Just like on the internet, think about the internet. Like, are you keeping track of, like, hey, like, if I'm looking for a recipe, I'm going to go to this place. If I want to look for like news on certain topic, I'm going to go there. You don't do that. Like, you know, it's not possible anymore because there's so much information is across so many different places.
So you got now this kind of core group of engineers. You have the funding. You need to build the product. Do you just go heads down and build, or do you partner with some design partners to figure out the subtleties of it? Like, how do you make that MVP work out?
Well, you absolutely have to have people. Like, there's no way to build a product, like, especially like this one, without any design partners. So that was the first task. As we started to sort of think about technology, I was although I'm an engineer, but I had all, like, any non-engineering task, you know, whether it's, you know, like ordering coffee for the office or figuring out, you know, design partners, that those are my tasks. And actually, it's very interesting. Like, I followed a very different process than typical. Like, I didn't actually go and, like, you know, hit my friends, you know, and say that, like, hey, can you actually, you know, take this product and give me feedback, because I felt like, you know, they'll all be very nice to me, and they will do it, like, you know, even if they don't have a need. So I actually went on LinkedIn and I would actually do cold outreach to people. And I would like, look, I'm building a product like this. Do you think, you know, do you have this problem? If you have this problem, I would love to talk to you and, like, you know, get your feedback, you know, so that I can build my product and, so, you know, like, you know, with, you know, direction from you. And so that's sort of, that was the journey that we went through, did a lot of.
Do you remember the specifics of that? Like, I'm curious, you know, did you have to send like 100 of these to get 10? You know, do you not remember high level how much volume you need to go through?
Yeah. Like, I had to do a lot. I don't think I was getting 1 out of 10 responses. Like, maybe I was initially, but then, like, you know, I was the BDR for my company for the first 2 years. And so the response rates would be low. Like, I've sent thousands of outreaches. You know, I'm looking for. And, like, you know, I understand, like, you know, everybody's busy. So, like, but when you get the response, you know, that's from a person who has that pain, because, you know, they're responding to somebody who they don't know, right? Somebody who, you know, like, you know, who has no brand, like, you know, in terms of, like, you know, nobody knew about our company. But so that means the problem must mean something, you know, some, like, problem is an acute pain for them, you know, because that's when they're responding.
And to be clear, your message wasn't, hey, I'm building this thing, do you want to buy it? It was very much like, you know, you might have this problem, let me ask you a few questions. That's kind of how you framed it in the early days.
Yeah, it was never about selling. Like, those outreach were never about selling, because in fact, we actually were not selling the product. We had no pricing, we had no plans to make revenue. That was an intentional decision we made, that we would actually not even charge for our product for the first 2 years.
And I'm curious, in those 2 years, how did you structure the team? Like, because you can easily, given the funding you had, I mean, you could build a very big team, or you could keep it small, 5 to 10. You know, I'm just curious how you structured it.
We got the team to about 20 people. That was our goal. And which is large. Like, sometimes for companies, you know, you don't start that way. But we knew that, you know, this is a difficult problem. So it requires a lot of R&D, lots of technology to be built. So we wanted to build a team of about 20 people and divide it into, like, you know, 3 different areas, you know, of our technology stack. And we felt that was basically the like a good team to actually make a lot of progress and build a great product. And then we stayed there. So it was sort of like, I would say, like, we got to about, you know, 10 people within the first 5 months. Then, like, gradually we got to 20, like, over the next 5 months. So, like, by the end of the first year, we were more than 20. And then we sort of stayed up, you know, there for some time. So we, like, that was a sufficient sort of strength that we had in our engineering team to keep making a lot of progress.
And, you know, you mentioned kind of taking a different approach. I mean, I can see it, because if you go for 2 years building a product without necessarily charging for it, you're certainly not following the, like, Eric Ries lean startup, you know, fast iteration MVP approach. Why not? Like, why didn't you just build the MVP that, like, the lowest thing that somebody would pay for, put it out and just kind of do what most startups tend to do?
Yeah, because we had a fundamental belief in the problem that we were solving. We didn't feel like, you know, we had to pivot. Like, our journey was not about that we're going to actually try something, we're going to learn something, we're going to change it and iterate. Sometimes, you know, we talk about product market fit here. Like for me, I think there was something about this problem. Like, I had no doubts that we will solve this problem. But I also, was aware, listening to customers, we're going to get a lot of different ideas. There are some decisions that you have to make which are fundamental yourself.
That's pretty incredible. I'm trying to kind of make sense of it. I mean, there's analogies, right? If you look at hardware as an example, like whether you take the iPhone or now the Vision Pro or whatever, you just can't iterate at that level. So you have to have, you of course talk to customers, but at some point you got to have that leap of faith, that conviction that puts you in a room for 2 years, so to speak, and builds a thing that really delivers value. I guess the challenge is when you, let's say, go against the grain, like in your example there, the market's saying one thing, you're like, no, I'm sticking on that vision. Obviously, you might end up 2 years later and the thing you build, nobody wants. So I'm just curious, like, how you think about that? How do you balance that? And even your advice to founders, because on the flip side, the lean startup method is so ingrained that almost everybody is just blindly running that motion. Maybe in some cases, it just doesn't apply.
Part of it is actually, what is the goal, you know, that this founder has? Is the goal to actually build a successful company, or is the goal to solve a problem, you know, something that you're passionate about? And so for me, it was the latter. I was not trying to get a win. I was actually trying to solve that problem. And so that's why we made those decisions. Like, we want to actually bring help to every single person. We want to make work more exciting, or we want to make work less frustrating for every single person in the world. For a first-time founder, like, you know, they're actually trying to, their goal is actually, you know, succeed as an entrepreneur. They want to actually learn that, you know, that art. Sort of like, you know, it's personal in that sense. You know, for me, that was not what I was looking for. For me, like, my focus and, like, you know, to not, you know, till date now, like, you know, all the decisions that we make, even today, are sort of driven by that thing, which is we want to actually solve this particular problem for people.
So as you're doing this, like, what's the threshold where you do launch? Like, what are you trying to get to where you feel like, okay, this product is ready to be sold?
Yeah. So as you said, like, you know, for the first 2 years we didn't charge. We wanted to see engagement. We wanted to see how much people are using the product on a daily basis. When we saw that it crossed 10 searches per day on average, that's when we knew that, well, look, now people are dependent on this product. They are actually getting value from it. And that's when we felt, you know, we were ready, you know, to charge for this product. Like, in our metrics were showing that both, you know, that they are actually finding things that they need, and also they're actually using the product a lot. So they're finding it useful to actually come and search here, as opposed to sort of, you know, using their old methods of finding.
And by the way, what was so hard about this product? Like, do you remember as you went through that development cycle, parts that just were really hard to make to work properly, or even places where you might have thought, I wonder if we can actually get this to the vision that you have?
Well, I mean, like, if you think about search, it's sort of like magic. Like, you can come in and ask any question, and like, now we have to answer that question for you. Like, this doesn't matter what question you came and asked. It's a difficult thing. You have to sort of now think about, like, you know, just imagine the process of how we're going to actually solve this problem. So first, you have to actually connect, you know, Glean with all of your company information and data across, like, hundreds of these systems that you have, all of them, like, you know, with clunky sort of APIs or interfaces and data models. And so you have to sort of bring information from all these different systems. You have to normalize it. Like, what information is stale? What is, like, out of date? Like, when you answer questions for people, like, don't show them stuff, you know, that's no longer, like, source of truth anymore. You have to think about, like, how do you semantically understand data and knowledge? Because, you know, people are not going to be, you know, you want people to be able to answer questions very freely in natural language. They can use terms that don't exist in the documents. So there's a lot of, like, you know, technology that goes behind the scenes to actually build a product like this. And we'd seen this, like, we've seen, like, how complicated the Google search stack was. Most of it actually did come from Google, and, you know, we worked on search there. So we sort of understood the complexity of it. And then you have to think about the security aspects of it, which is that, like, you know, imagine this, and I go to Pepsi or some large company and tell them that, hey, look, like, you know, we have this great search product. Like, you know, what we need is we need you to give all of your data to us, and then we'll actually, you know, make it searchable for you. And they're going to wonder, like, you know, like, okay, who are you? And, you know, it's a no brand company, like, and you want all my access to all my data. Like, you know, that's an issue. So if you start to think about the problem, like, although the problem is actually very meaningful, you know, there are a lot of challenges, you know.
And how much did the advances in AI, like LLMs and all these sort of things, did that play into what you were able to build at Glean? Was that kind of a tailwind for you guys?
Absolutely. And actually, like, it's always been part of Glean. So even on day one, our product were using LLMs. You know, now, of course, everybody talks about LLMs and, like, you know, and we've all seen that, like, how powerful they are. But they were actually initially, like, you know, all of this research happened in Google. And LLMs were actually, or these language models were actually built, you know, with one purpose, which is to make search better, to make Google search better. So when we started, we were actually able to use these BERT family of language models that Google had actually published in open domain. These were language models that were trained on all of the world's knowledge. And so they understood things like a user manual and a product guide are semantically equivalent things. Right? So this model actually has all of that language understanding and, you know, buried inside of it. And so we were able to use these models from day one to build a really smart semantic search experience. We were doing vector embeddings and now everybody calls this vector search, you know, there's no name for it, like, when we were using it initially. So it's sort of like, you know, the journey has been a continuous one for us. Like, it's not that, like, you know, 4 years later, we realized that there's this massive new, like, you know, like, language model thing, then, and we need to, like, change our stack with it. Like, we're progressively using it. And these models just kept getting better and better. So it allowed us to actually also make our product better. So initially, like, you know, it looked more like, you know, the traditional Google. you know, where you come and ask questions and we'll surface that information back to you. So it's sort of like the technology has been amazing, amazing sort of enabler in terms of making a product better. But it's also like amazing for us in terms of helping us push our business. And this is where, you know, the transition happened from the vitamin to the painkiller. When people saw that if only I had something like ChatGPT inside my company or all of my company knowledge, people realized that, whoa, like that, no, this is something I absolutely have to have.
It makes sense. I think like a lot of these products that are kind of like step changes, you only realize later how much of a painkiller they are. I mean, Google itself, like search itself is kind of like that. I'm sure before it, you ask people, hey, you could ask like a million different questions a day. You'd be like, well, I don't have that many questions. And then you realize you do. You just constantly everything that pops in your brain, right? So let me ask this kind of final question. You take these 2 years, you know, in 2021, you raised the $40 million Series B. My question is like around that time frame. I mean, once you launch this product, how fast did revenue grow? Like how long did it take to get to a million in revenue or 5 million in revenue? Do you remember those days?
So we've been actually growing at about 3 to 4x like every year in terms of multiplying our revenues. We probably hit like the right after we launched, because we did have like a good set of design partners. And so there's a big pipeline that was already built for us. So getting to like, I think our the first year of selling, like we did $3 million, if I remember right now.
Perfect. Well, we'll stop it there. Appreciate you kind of taking us through the journey. I'll just end with two questions that we always end with. The first one is, you know, I mean, in your case specifically, you understood the problem deeply, but I'm still curious, like, when did you really know that you had kind of true product market fit?
I think I knew it on day one. I mean, that's it. Like I knew that we were going to go through this challenge of trying to convince people, you know, of the value of the product, but we're ready for that. Like we're ready to actually, you know, build our team, you know, like evangelize and convince people because there's never a doubt in my mind that the people want this product. Like whenever I go and talk to anybody, they tell me they want this product. So like then, so there's no doubt. It was just a matter of cultivating the market. Like, you know, we thought that the journey would be slow, but like in the sense that we had to, you know, constantly, you know, go and create the market, evangelize, you know, we also like, you know, it changed in the last like 18 months. And now suddenly, like, you know, we have something that everybody in the world wants. So it's sort of accelerating us and our business.
Perfect. And the last question is, you know, after going through founding Rubrik and now founding Glean and creating two multi-billion dollar companies, what advice do you have, taking everything you've learned, for first-time founders that are starting, or maybe not even first-time founders, but founders that are starting something new today?
Yeah, I mean, my number one advice to founders is conviction and persistence. So if you see a problem that's out there, then don't think too much about who else is solving it or how big the market is. Just go and solve the problem, like, you know, and persist and believe, you know, believe in it. And there's going to be ups and downs. There's going to be enough people, you know, telling you that like, hey, look, you know, I see this problem, but I don't see myself paying for it. Don't worry about all of that part. If you think that, you know, it's a large enough problem, like a lot of people face it, then having that conviction and belief and like staying on course is, I think, this is the most important thing. As engineers, like, you know, a lot of times, you know, founders are engineers and, like, you know, our mindset is to sort of doubt. And so I tell people, you hear these stats that 9 out of 10 startups fail. And I like to tell them that, like, look, no, it's not 9 out of 10. It's 99 out of 100 because you didn't count all the first 90 startups that the founder killed themselves. Like, you know, sometimes the startup fail afterwards, but most of them fail in the mind of the founder. So if there's a problem, you can solve it and it doesn't matter who else is out there.
Perfect. Love that. Well, Arvind, thanks a lot for spending the time. This was great.
Appreciate that. Thank you for having me.
If you listen to this episode and the show and you like it, I have a huge favor to ask for you. Well, it's actually a really small favor, but it has huge impact. But whichever app you're listening to this episode on, take it out, go to Product Market Fit Show and leave a review, please. It's going to help. It's not just going to help me, to be clear. It's going to help other founders discover the show because the algorithms, whether it's Spotify, whether it's Apple, whether it's any other podcast player, one of the big things they look at is frequency of reviews. It's quantity of reviews. And the reality is if all of you listening right now left reviews, we would have thousands of reviews. So please take literally a minute, even if you're just writing like great podcast or I love this podcast, whatever it is, just write a few words. Obviously, the longer the better, the more detailed the better, but write anything, leave 5 stars and you will be helping me, but most importantly, many other founders just like you discover the show. Thank you.